Belt needs planting a month ago, and at the latest a week ago. What will we do? Well, what do you want to do? You have at least four choices. Find a farmer and rent equipment, if you can garner enough funds. Plant later than optimum and remain marginal in crop production. And or as soon as possible, begin to work the land for next spring and some summer crops. Or leave it lay fallow and try to get some equipment of smaller variety to get the weeds under control. If you choose to have a late year planting of spelt, I can give you to the middle of November and offer rain to start the seeds, or at the least help winter them. Past mid-November, it is unworthy of effort or seeds for a winter crop. If you choose to plant late, you will have to plant very heavily so that the grain can get up and smother out the weeds in early spring. Or would you be better to simply get another silo or two up and buy grain? Well, Cheelas, this is a hard one because there is no way to tell until Mr. Jackson does his job to see funds for major storage on Turner's property, which he plans to sell as soon as he can do so. He has to, as he is in financial trouble. Will Mr. Jackson get his job done? I honestly do not know when he shall do anything. The structure is in place, the agreements made, but hang-ups are still working. Just remember something. All the hours and work and investment into the various operations located at that farm before you toss in the towel. Perhaps a Thanksgiving weekend of painting, roofing, and winterizing might be better than gorging selves on feasting and celebration.
Or go out there and Dorm will bake you a turkey.
Oh.
I will volunteer her while she can't do anything about it.
No, I'm not suggesting that you do the entire farm by hand. I do suggest that you who want Dorma to fix it for speaking out, go get the keys from Mr. Entz, make him account for his misdeeds and missing equipment, and at the least stop protecting the problem, so that when we can get the farming underway, the other problems are not staring you in the face also. And by the way, if there are others who don't want to participate in such adventures, why stay around where the problems annoy you? Then there is the vegetable patch and berry vines. Each without water and overfilled with weeds. The vegetables are now ruined from frost, and nobody harvests the good remaining. The thought comes, why does God bother with us when we have so little respect for his gifts? Entz took all the tractor and plow equipment to his own private location for auction after running the funds through the Institute to cover the notes while serving as president of the board of directors of the Institute. Fine, he arranged for the funds from his mother, so he uses the money, but either the Institute has to repay the notes or the funds are lost and the Institute must account for them. Upstanding? No, I don't think so, friends. Or perhaps my ideals of rightness and wrongness are warped, but I don't think so. Did you expect it to be somehow different because this was our mission, our projects, our journey? Indeed you did. Now, perhaps, we can get on with our jobs with proper attention to the tasks at hand. We no longer will tolerate the slipshod management of business ventures by the ones who just come for God to take care of. When a man will say how wondrous God is for always providing, you can bet your last penny that somebody in the shape of a human being is attending the needs while the taker laughs at you. You queasy ladies with the little children should go to the farm and look at the dead cats behind the barn. What killed them? What happened to the birds and farm fowl? Well, they were fortunately sold because there came a buyer, but they were not anxious to sell without consultation. Now you say, well, they had to sell them to move after eviction. Number one, they were not evicted. Number two, just through Rod Entz, they were provided with a home, utilities, a vehicle, and all living expenses. They had assistance for food and dental medical for the children. In addition, the income alone was well over $50,000 a year, roughly calculated, without considering the personal income from crops or eggs. If there were repairs, the cost was covered by others, and others provided the work in most instances. And the children were paid by others for their services, good or bad, at the wages of the men. Ah, but you want Dharma, who finally could no longer work hard enough to continue the pay scale, to fix it, because somehow she represents the voice of God and must not offend or respond as human. It becomes too much. How many of you felt Ensign's got a raw deal at the farm and gave parties to them who weren't going anywhere save stepping up into better housing, have gone to help salvage the farm? How many of you have picked one millet spray or cleaned out the knee-deep horse stall or the bird or chicken coops, left without so much as emptying the feed dishes? Please spare me, readers, and do not ask for more and more and more until you attend the mess left for, again, Dharma and EJ along with Charles to attend. Art, thank you for unstintingly giving of your talents and work to get milling equipment rolling again. Gene Holloway and Bob James, thank you for pitching in to help. And thank you, Jeff, for tending Spud. He is old and lonely, and Turner can't spend time with him. Ed Cleary kissed off his debts to us and took off for Tennessee and parts east. He said he was going where he was appreciated, and that he should have been placed in charge of all these plans, if they are of God, because he has 80-some-odd years of experience and was a priest in the Catholic Church. Come again? He and others took thousands of dollars to use to get what they hoped would be financing from the Philippines to do the projects necessary, and kissed it off with, quote, "It's none of your business." Whose business is it? People, whose business is it? He is now gone to look over possibilities and would be back for his farewell party. Well, I hope so, for he is a friend, and he edited and tried to find resources. But I wonder. He is elderly. He was severed from his priesthood by the church long, long, long ago. Who will attend him? Who will care for and love him when he is ill and infirm? The problem is, friends, when you kiss off God, you haven't much remaining with which to hold or protect. Is this house cleaning? Is this sorting? Some object to just tossing aside the upheavals as sorting cells. But I ask you, how do you sort? How much does the landlord tolerate from the tenant who is working against him constantly and destroying rather than building? How much? How long do you allow the taking from others, like you, for self, and then cast rocks back at the ones who finally cannot go on carrying the burden? Is it lack of communication? Really? No, you object to speaking of problems as gossip, while others have to bear the burden of the assaults, while you close your eyes and minds and pretend the problem doesn't exist. Then when the back breaks from the last straw piled on, you protect the straw piler and kick the beast of burden. Is this godly? No, it is foolishness. As we make efforts to sit again together, it is awkward and feelings are high and confused. This is fine, people, for you will respond to anything in reaction, but it is time to find the routing of reason and response instead of the immediate assumptions and actions without insight. This is exactly why you have to know what is wrong with your world and your government, your nation or your neighbor, before you launch out with militias, guns, and solutions which will only slay your own people, lose your assets, and end you up in prisons instead of that freedom you seek and demand. You cannot change a world by objecting and getting into prison over the little laws such as seat belts and driver's licenses, for these things are not the problem. You have to know what is wrong, or has gone wrong, or has changed, and look at the who, why, what, where, and when of every instance before you act without wisdom and insight. These are the major lessons to be learned from the little individual encounters of farms and lawsuits. You have to know how things are required to work before simply blasting out in accusations and false recognition. We did not, for instance, drive away anyone. We even sought every conceivable way to shift without hurting while upgrading them. We have no animosity now, even after the bashing, for we understand misunderstandings and inner pain while worrying and concerning over the children, actually the family as a whole. But to then be called evil leaders and spy and evictors. While full intent was to shift, replace, and restructure, while vacating the premises to try and salvage something of the mess is unacceptable. In the beginning, no one blamed, and month after downhill month, it was one meeting and agreement made following another, each broken by rod. And then the objection flows back that we should understand. No, we don't need to understand the foolish statements of another who doesn't know anything about the circumstances and are fed misperceptions and outright lies. The problem becomes as racism or cultism focus. The entire of the flock has to be included in the chicken clutch, which was likely not unified in the first place. However, look carefully at all facets of a given problem and see how really far back go the assumptions of any current encounter. Note the traits, the deceptions, the chattering, the minding of everyone's business, the little problems introduced innocently, the hurtful gossip or silly staging of events and circumstances. All these things grow and grow, and finally, if not attended, burst forth in full-blown explosion. Then comes the home environment and how it is structured and works. Do each of the parties involved contribute equally, but each to his own task or output? Or do the parties just exist, waiting on the others to support them in every encounter and along life's journey? How long can the lopsided load be carried by the other? Well, let me remind you that when, finally, the respect goes, there goes everything of value, because sex becomes control and in love is already gone. Ponder it. As long as you call the wrong things love, you will never find love. You may well have codependence, but that indicates some sort of immature addiction to pain and dissatisfaction in the world of fantasy land and self-punishment. When the loser is tossed out on his or her ear, they grow up or find another to live off as parasites who carry unrest and unhappiness with them as surely as night follows day. This is as real with a nation as a couple. Your right is to allow whatever you will, but not to cause any other to have to endure your choices. I am not being hard or callous to anyone, any group, or any country. This is just the way it is. If these shoes fit, then wear them. But do not complain if they pinch or expect someone else to fix it. These are simple facts of living. I am reminded of Daylene's story of her dreams, which bothered her and appeared every time she was faced with hard decisions and problems. She would be trying to move, but attached to her was a rumpled bed and rusty frame. Every time, in dream work, she chose that focus to try and see why she always dragged that rumpled bed everywhere she went, as involved problems and sometimes even when she was quite happy. This went on for several years, and it always left her sad and depressed. So, dreams are yours. They mean only something to you. You write the dreams, live the dreams, and the meanings are singularly yours. So you know what they mean and have to decipher that answer for self. There are ways to play at this game of deciphering, and it usually only takes a minute with a partner knowing what to do and demand and ask to have a aha solution appear as if from nowhere. Well, a few minutes into the questioning and answering, the aha came, bursting into the mind. Quote, I made my own bed, and I have to drag it and sleep in it as is, or make it, change it, and or get rid of it. She immediately changed the sheets and cut the shackles and finds life carries a lot more insight. If, by the way, Daylene, if that bed shows up again, I suggest you look at it carefully before you change those old sheets, however, for the problem will not be the same. Life is one encounter after another that probably disagrees with what you think a thing should be. That is life. What you need is more preparation for living and relationships, and less trying to change the sheets when they aren't dirty but simply don't fit the bed. You may be the one most difficult to live with, not the perceived other party, from your viewpoint. It is when both are willing to work to resolve the confrontations and problems that maturity, love, respect, communion, can enter into the picture? Or do you just continue to tear down the other and finally, in the throes of facing the circumstances, turn away and blame another or others for your own addiction or predicament? How can you have a healthy and balanced life flow with sick people? How do you get well? Get off your ego and get busy seeing within and looking at self first, and then work with that other, be it one or a billion, to see what you can do. If it is not your problem, then move away and release. Providing crutches to an uncrippled person is not a solution. You have to take responsibility for self, and if you like your predicament, stay in it. But when you build a strong and right foundation for self, emotionally, you may find you are quite weary and broken from the burden of carrying another's habits and demands, or just being as an ornament to clutter your space. You can push on a wet noodle forever and not budget one iota from its place where it has glued itself to the table, but you can get out there and detach self and get in front and pull it. If you pull and the noodle breaks, get the hell out of your own way. Or at least get the hell out of my way so I can get my job done. Is this hard or unfair? Neither. It is absolutely reasonable and more than fair if the other has been warned. Threats are of no value. Be responsible in truth, for self then require that the other be responsible, and then squarely face the circumstance and make necessary changes in attitude or purpose, see how the bed is rumpled or tidy, dare to take a chance and move on, or quit complaining about your plight. You made that bed, drag that bed, and you will lie in it. It is the law of the universe. When you get weary enough and crippled enough from dragging the bed, you will change it. I bid you good morning. Salute.
I think we better have cake. I'm all in favor of dropping the subject and moving on. Salute.
And we stand up to defend ourselves.
You know, this is the Million Man March, and there are black men all over this place. But, you know, the one person who has had the biggest response so far has been a woman, Maya Angelou. What did you think about her remarks this moment?
Oh, man, she was unreal. I mean, you can't hear enough of her. She was great. All her poems are outstanding. I can't say enough about her.
Is this going to change you as a person when you leave here?
You know, while I'm sitting here waiting, I mean, these things going through my mind, for sure.
What does it make you think about
it? It makes you think, it makes you feel loved and warm with your brothers, because, you know, you're walking on the streets every day and riding down the street. I mean, you constantly get attacked by your own people.
Right.
And it's giving me a different view. About my brother.
Right, I hate to cut you off, champ. We want to go right to the podium because we've got perhaps the youngest person who has addressed this crowd today and talking right now.
Dare to be different. And when you have fought back and regained your pride, when you have won some battle, when you are able to tell the stories of your heroism, when you can pass on to your young the tradition of struggle through examples of your having stood up for a better tomorrow, when you take control of our institutions, our media, our schools, when you maximize our economic resources towards our own benefit, when you stop making excuses, when you start standing with our mothers, when you stick it out with your families, when you start mentoring our young, when you start teaching us to be humane, then we can build a new nation of strong people. Your sons and daughters will no longer need to belong to gangs because they do belong. Our youth will no longer be seeking drugs as an escape because they would have outlets in our society to develop themselves. When you start setting the conditions for our youth to fulfill their humanity, then we will not be in despair. We will be whole, complete, and hopeful. My fathers, you must shape the vision of tomorrow. But in order for that vision to become a reality, you must rededicate yourself to a new beginning. Go back to your family. families. Go raise and teach your children. Go back and organize throughout this nation to bring about a better day for our people. Our enemies can destroy us one by one, but no one can stop 1 million men organized and committed. Thank you.
My big brother,
that was Allende Baptiste addressing the crowd, the youngest person to do so today, and Mike Spinks still with us, just listening to that. What do you think about hearing, coming all the way here and hearing a young man, a very young man, speaking in such striking terms there?
We know we have a long way. That they desire for us. You speaking the truth. We have a lot to say.
The change that people who came to this march are trying to affect in their communities when they go back is exactly what that young man was talking about. They want every young man to be able to talk that way and think that way and feel that way.
Exactly. I would love to be able to talk to myself. Yeah.
Well,
that is not Islam.
As-salamu alaykum. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, I bear witness that there is no God but Allah who came in the person of Master Farad Muhammad. And I bear witness that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is his true servant. And I further bear witness that Minister Louis Farrakhan is his divine reminder in our midst. On behalf of my family, my mother here, my wife at home, and my children, we have been the brunt of a whole lot of attacks. And those of you who know the plight of my father know that whenever any black man is in trouble, he always comes to your aid. Never be ashamed to stand up and say that Farrakhan is a friend of the black man. And I want all, and I challenge all of the leaders, that when you are asked by your enemies and those who oppressed us, my father is not a bigot. He's not a racist. He is not an anti-Semite. And we have the history in our archive that will prove everything that I'm telling you. So, from the president on down to everybody who's under him, Farrakhan is in your midst today. You don't have to think about what he said or listen to anybody about what he said. Call him yourself and ask him what he said. I present to you the man that God has given this vision to. For without the vision, the people will perish. And I say to you that my father is here to speak to you. So listen to him very carefully. I bring to you my leader, my teacher, my guide, my father, your brother, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. Let us receive him. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Brother Farrakhan,
thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, we thank him for his prophets and the scriptures which they brought. We thank him for Moses and the Torah. We thank him for Jesus and the Gospel. We thank him for Muhammad and the Quran. Peace be upon these worthy servants of Allah. I am so grateful to Allah for his intervention in our affairs in the person of Master Farad Muhammad, the great Mahdi, who came among us and raised from among us a divine leader, teacher, and guide, his messenger to us, the most honorable Elijah Muhammad. I greet all of you, my dear and wonderful brothers, with the greeting words of peace. We say it in the Arabic language, Assalamu alaikum. I would like to thank all of those known and unknown persons who worked to make this day of atonement and reconciliation a reality. My thanks and my extreme gratitude to the Reverend Benjamin Chavis and to all of the members of the National Organizing Committees, to all of the local organizing committees, to Dr. Dorothy Height in the National Council of Negro Women, and all of the sisters who were involved in the planning of the Million Man March. Of course, if I named all those persons whom I know helped to make this event a reality, it would take a tremendous amount of time, but suffice it to say that we are grateful to all who made this day possible. We are grateful to those who put up the sound and the screen. We are grateful to all of the technical people who have made this possible, to all of the security personnel. My heartfelt thanks to Mr. Robert Johnson, the CEO of BET, for having the Reverend Chavis, Dr. Cornell West, and myself with Bev Smith on our voices to help inform our people of the purpose for the Million Man March and for taking out a full page endorsing the march in the USA Today newspaper. We thank all of the black newspapers, radio stations, commentators, disc jockeys who really talked up the Million Man March. The mass media did not get involved until the last minute, and it seemed as though they got involved with another agenda in mind. But to all of you, and we thank you, a mass media too, because even though you planned it for mischief, God planned it for good, so we thank you very much for helping to make this day successful. And to all who participated in the program and who helped to formulate the program, to all the singers, the dancers, the performers, the speakers, to all of the celebrities, to the members of the Congressional Black Caucus, to all of the religious leaders who are present, to all of the state legislators, to everyone that made this day possible, words are inadequate to express our heartfelt thanks, but really in truth, all thanks, all praise, all honor, all glory belongs to God. For this is the day that the Lord has made. So we are here rejoicing in this day. Certainly, to all of the members of the Nation of Islam, to all of the ministers, captains, secretaries, and sister captains, to all of the foot soldiers who worked to raise money that this day could be produced, and hopefully all of our vendors be paid. It is not adequate to express our deep sense of personal gratitude, so all I can say is thanks, thanks, thanks. Thank you. Now, where are we gathered? We're standing at the steps of the United States Capitol. I'm looking at the Washington Monument and beyond it to the Lincoln Memorial. And beyond that, to the left, to your right, the Jefferson Memorial. Abraham Lincoln was the 16th president of these United States, and he was the man who allegedly freed us. Abraham Lincoln saw in his day what President Clinton sees in this day. He saw the great divide between black and white. Abraham Lincoln and Bill Clinton see what the Kerner Commission saw 30 years ago when they said that this nation was moving toward two Americas, one black, one white, separate and unequal. And the Kerner Commission revisited their findings 25 years later and saw that America was worse today than it was in the time of Martin Luther King Jr. There's still two Americas, one black, one white, separate and unequal. Abraham Lincoln, when he saw this great divide, he pondered a solution of separation. Abraham Lincoln said he never was in favor of our being jurors or having equal status with the whites of this nation. Abraham Lincoln said that if there were to be a superior or inferior, he would rather the superior position be assigned to the white race. There in the middle of this mall is the Washington Monument, 555 feet high. But if we put a one in front of that 555 feet, we get 1555, the year that our first fathers landed on the shores of Jamestown, Virginia, as slaves. In the background is the Jefferson and Lincoln Memorial. Each one of these monuments is 19 feet high. Abraham Lincoln, the 16th president. Thomas Jefferson, the 3rd president. And 16 and 3 make 19 again. What is so deep about this number 19? Why are we standing on the Capitol step today? That number 19, when you have a 9, you have a womb that is pregnant. And when you have a 1 standing by the 9, it means that there's something secret that has to be unfolded. Right here on this mall where we are standing, according to books written on Washington, D.C., slaves used to be brought right here on this mall in chains to be sold up and down the eastern seaboard, right along this mall, going over to the White House. Our fathers were sold into slavery. But George Washington, the first president of the United States, said, He feared that before too many years passed over his head, this slave would prove to become a most troublesome species of property. Thomas Jefferson said he trembled for this country when he reflected that God was just and that his justice could not sleep forever. Well, the day that these presidents feared has now come to pass. For on this mall, here we stand in the capital of America, and the layout of this great city, laid out by a black man, Benjamin Banneker. This is all placed and based in a secret Masonic ritual. And at the core of the secret of that ritual is the black man. Not far from here is the White House. And the first president of this land, George Washington, who was a grand master of the Masonic order, laid the foundation, the cornerstone of this Capitol building where we stand. George was a slave owner. George was a slave owner. Now the president spoke today, and he wanted to heal the great divide. But I respectfully suggest to the president, you did not dig deep enough at the malady that divides black and white in order to effect a solution to the problem. And so today we have to deal with the root so that perhaps a healing can take place. Now this obelisk at the Washington Monument is Egyptian. And this whole layout is reminiscent of our great historic past, Egypt. And if you look at the original seal of the United States, published by the Department of State in 1909, Gaylord Hunt wrote that late in the afternoon of July 4th, 1776, the Continental Congress resolved that Dr. Benjamin Franklin, Mr. John Adams, and Mr. Thomas Jefferson be a committee to prepare a device for a seal of the United States of America. In the design proposed by the first committee, the face of the seal was a coat of arms measured in 6 quarters. That number is significant. 6 quarters, with emblems representing England, Scotland, Ireland, France, Germany, and Holland, the countries from which the new nation had been peopled. The eye of Providence in a radiant triangle and the motto E Pluribus Unum were also proposed for the face of the seal. Even though the country was populated by so-called Indians and black slaves were brought to build the country, the official seal of the country was never designed to reflect our presence, only that of the European immigrants. The seal and the Constitution reflect the thinking of the founding fathers that this was to be a nation by white people and for white people. Native Americans, blacks, and all other non-white people were to be the burden bearers for the real citizens of this nation. For the back of the seal, the committee suggested a picture of Pharaoh sitting in an open chariot with a crown on his head and a sword in his hand, passing through the divided waters of the Red Sea in pursuit of the Israelites. And hovering over the sea was to be shown a pillar of fire in a cloud, expressive of the divine presence and command. And rays from this pillar of fire were to be shown beaming down on Moses, standing on the shore, extending his hand over the sea, causing it to overwhelm Pharaoh. The motto for the reverse was, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Let me say it again. Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Now, why did they mention Pharaoh? I heard the president say today, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. But in the past, out of many comes one, meant out of many Europeans come one people. The question today is, out of the many Asians, the many Arabs, the many Native Americans, the many blacks, the many people of color who populate this country, do you mean for them to be made into the one? If so, truth has to be spoken to justice. We can't cover things up, cover them over, give it a pretty sound to make people feel good. We have to go to the root of the problem. Now, why have you come today? You came not at the call of Louis Farrakhan, but you have gathered here at the call of God. For it is only the call of Almighty God, no matter whom, through whom that call came, that could generate this kind of outpouring. God called us here to this place at this time for a very specific reason. And now, I want to say, my brothers, this is a very pregnant moment, pregnant with the possibility of tremendous change in our status in America and in the world. And although the call was made through me, many have tried to distance the beauty of this idea from the person through whom the idea and the call was made. Some have done it mistakenly, and others have done it in a malicious and vicious manner. Brothers and sisters, there is no human being through whom God brings an idea that history doesn't marry the idea with that human being, no matter what defect was in that human being's character. You can't separate Newton from the law that Newton discovered. Nor can you separate Einstein from the theory of relativity. It would be silly to try to separate Moses from the Torah, or Jesus from the Gospel, or Muhammad from the Quran. Well, you say, Farrakhan, you ain't no Moses, you ain't no Jesus, and you're not no Muhammad. You have a defect in your character. Well, that certainly may be so. However, according to the way the Bible reads, there is no prophet of God written of in the Bible that did not have a defect in his character. But I have never heard any member of the faith